Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Well, thank you very much, Roy, for that introduction, and thank you to all of you as well for making time to be here. I'm really happy to have the chance to speak to you and to just be able to share some time speaking about St. Thomas's thought, particularly his Eucharistic theology and how we can think about that in relation to something as important as grace and Trinitarian communion. So this talk will have sort of three basic parts, right? So I'm going to begin by talking about sacraments in general and how sacraments relate to the human person in God's providential plan and how that works within the Eucharist specifically as a sacrament. I'll also be speaking about the Eucharist as a sacrifice. So unlike other sacraments, the Eucharist is not only a sacrament, but a sacrifice. So I'll say more about that. And in that particular context, when thinking about the Eucharist as a sacrifice, I'm going to say a bit about human acts and what it means to be drawn into Trinitarian communion by the power of grace, and how specific kinds of virtues help not only with that general trajectory of divinization, so we can think of the three theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, for example, but in their specific moral virtues. And here I'm thinking of the virtue of religion specifically, and I'll say more about that in a second part, that the virtue of religion provides a framework in St. Thomas's thought for thinking about sacramental participation on the one hand, liturgy, and in a special sense in the Eucharist, our participation in the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So that'll be the second part. In the final part, I'll talk a little bit about the nature of grace, what grace is, how it's related to the Trinity, and how the Trinity is a kind of backdrop for an understanding of grace as divine image. And I'll conclude that section with a specific focus on the Eucharist, speaking about the way in which the Eucharist specifically is a sacrament. All the sacraments divinize us. All the sacraments draw us into the communion of God. But the Eucharist specifically has a special relationship with the virtue of charity. And so I'll close by speaking about the importance of charity in the context of our own Eucharistic life and what it means to receive an increase of charity as an effect of the Eucharist. So the first section deals with sacraments and the human person. St. Thomas's thought on the sacraments is premised in many ways on St. Augustine and a number of high medieval thinkers such as Hugh of St. Victor, for example, and Peter Lombard, other Victorines, who are inheritors of aspects of Augustine's thought. This provides a kind of sacramental world in the high medieval West, which informs Aquinas' approach to things as disparate or seemingly disparate as the incarnation of Jesus Christ and the material of the sacraments as selected by divine wisdom, and the way in which those material elements, for example, the water of baptism or the bread and wine of the Eucharist, are related back to the broader context of recreation through the power of the incarnation. The two Victorine authors that I mentioned just now, Peter Lombard and Hugh of St. Victor, both make a great deal out of the language of sacrament and sign as a broader theological motif for understanding reality from the perspective of divine revelation. That is to say, what does reality look like when viewed through the eyes of faith, when we look at reality through the formalities that God has infused into our intellect and will? And that's precisely what he's done through the theological virtues by giving us the infused gifts of faith, hope, and charity. What does reality look like through the eyes of faith? What does it mean to love God through the formality of the theological life, through the formality of that life which is drawing us in communion now towards the eventual heavenly reality of beatitude? It produces a different picture of reality, which for the high medieval thinkers was centered around the Trinity. It was centered around the incarnation as a form of recreation in grace. So St. Paul speaks of grace as a kind of recreation of human nature, not simply a forensic fix, if you will, in an external sense of something that went wrong in original sin, but in a deeper and more intrinsic sense, grace renovates and recreates the human person from the inside out, if you will, elevating the teleology of human acts, the directedness of human acts, not only according to their final object, but according to their mean, the way by which they operate, in a pattern which is directed towards Trinitarian indwelling and communion with the Trinity directly. For St. Augustine, the pattern of recreation is structured very much by the distinction between things and signs. Now, in Augustine's understanding, all things is simply a vocabulary for speaking about creation. That is to say, existing things, if I had a tree in my hand, which I don't, but if I did, it would be a thing, right? It could also be a sign of all sorts of things about God as a creator. So where did the tree come from? It could be, if you see it through the right lens, it could be a sign of God's goodness, his power, his wisdom, the order he imparts to creation, all sorts of things like that. So things, in one sense, they simply signify themselves, or they don't point, let's say, beyond themselves. So the tree is just a tree, right? But in another sense, it's a sign of other things. Now, that's a natural sign. That is to say, a sign which exists simply in nature. Nobody needed to impose meaning on that tree, right, to get a further signification. We just had to pay a bit more attention, right, to the tree and where it came from to get that kind of natural signification going, where we see the beauty and order of creation, for example, as not simply an end in and of itself, but a signate pattern of signs, which leads back to the creator. Now, for St. Augustine, natural signs in this way are very useful, precisely because they remind us of the source of reality, which is ultimately the Trinity itself. Augustine will say, and Aquinas will repeat this, citing Augustine, that all of reality is either an image or a trace of the Holy Trinity. A trace in this sense, and this is Augustine in De Doctrina Christiana, if you're interested, a trace is like footprints in the snow. You don't see the animal that made the prints, but you know the animal was there simply by following the breadcrumbs of signs, if you will, to see the footprints. Another example will be smoke on the horizon. So you don't see the fire, but you see the smoke. Smoke is a sign of the fire, and you deduce rightly that there must be a fire causing the smoke. An image, however, is different from a simple sign in the sense of remnant or trace. An image is where we see the cause itself. It's like not only seeing the smoke, but seeing the fire that causes it. For Augustine, that's a particular illustration of the human person as image of the Trinity, where all of creation is a trace, a kind of likeness of the Trinity. We see something of the Trinity as the cause, ultimately, of what's made. In the human person, again, if we have eyes to see, particularly eyes opened by the infused elevation of faith, the human person emerges as a kind of image of the Trinity, not unlike the fire itself. So as the fire reflects the nature of fire, so too, beholding the human person, in a sense, is to behold a kind of image of the Trinity. Now, Aquinas, and here this Augustine would affirm this as well, will say that the human person is an imperfect image of the Trinity. That shouldn't surprise us too much, since we're creatures, we're not God, obviously. But the image is imperfect according to the similitude of nature. Whereas the Father and the Son, the Trinitarian persons of the Father and the Son, bear a perfect similitude of nature, and a natural Father and a Son. There's a kind of similitude of nature there too. They're both human persons, of course, but there's a family resemblance. The eternal Word is a perfect image of the eternal Father. We, by derivation, are imperfect images. So we don't have a similitude of nature as such. We don't actually have the divine nature, right? But we have stamped within ourselves a kind of image. And that image, again, following the Augustinian tradition, is the pattern of intellect and will, knowing and loving, the rational faculties that make us human. And so for Aquinas, building on this tradition, the discovery, if you will, of God through the process of knowing and loving, not only in an intellective sense, although that's the first step, knowing God, but then loving what we know, knowing it to be good. And because it's good, it can be the object of love, leads not only in a natural sense to knowing things about God, but in a special sense in the order of grace, that same noetic pattern leads to possession. And Aquinas says this specifically in question 43 of the Prima Pars of the Summa, if you're interested. That is to say, that because the noetic structure of the human person as image has this ability to possess its object, to know and to love something, it can do that not only through creation, with created things, knowing the tree as a sign of the goodness of God, for example, but because of God's condescension in revelation, because God has chosen to share something of his own life through the gift of grace, God himself becomes the object of the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity. And so that pattern of theological life allows for a new understanding, a new appropriation, rather, of signs in relation to things to emerge in the economy of grace. In one sense, recreation is premised on creation itself. The name itself gives it away, of course. But theologically speaking, recreation not only fixes what was wrong, but uses the existing material to make something better, as it were, to elevate, to renovate existing creation, and to draw it more deeply into the heart of God. And so when we think about recreation in relation to signs, what the incarnation does, and this you can find in Augustine, Lombard, Hugh of St. Victor, and Aquinas, the incarnation imposes a new manifold of signs, effectively, a new matrix of signs, which are specifically Christological, upon reality. Now, this happens in a number of ways, and it's key to understanding what Aquinas is doing with the sacraments in the Tertia Pars of the Summa. Signs, effectively, for Aquinas and for Augustine, are sacramental signs, that is, I should say. Sacramental signs are signs of holiness. That is to say, they signify the sanctification and divinization of the human person. So that whole process of noetic rehabilitation, where the Trinitarian image within us is not only discovered, uncovered, if you will, from the refuse of original sin and all sorts of other forms of misguided self-love that plague our post-lapsarian state, not only discovered, but embraced and allowed to breathe, as it were, in the life of grace and to grow strong with God himself as the object. That process of renovation and recreation, the signs of the law of grace, particularly sacramental signs, signify the ongoing unfolding of that process. So in question 60 of the Tertia Pars, Aquinas uses a kind of analogy, and it's an analogy of attribution or a prose head analogy, if you're interested. So it's an analogy of many to one. That is to say, one term, many significations, or one exemplar, many participants. A similar analogy would be the transcendentals, like goodness, truth, or oneness. We predicate them of the divine essence in a simple sense. God is goodness. God is truth. He's the source of all goodness. But we also predicate good of many things in creation, many things, being itself and our perception of the good in our moral acts, or virtuous acts, perceive that correctly, whereas sometimes you know, there's other things going on. But that sense of goodness as a kind of many-to-one relationship. The analogy that Aquinas draws here is a comparison between bodily health and deification or sanctification and grace. So it's a comparison between sanus, or healthy, and sancta, right, holy. So how do we say healthy, for example, of a human person? It's in a similar way, Aquinas is going to say we say holy of the same person. Now, there's a couple senses in which Aquinas develops this, again, in the beginning of his treatment of the sacraments in the Tertia Pars. But healthy can be said of an animal, for example, in a number of different senses. It can be said as a cause. Medicine is a cause of health, for example. It can be predicated as a kind of formal quality that this animal possesses health. This body is healthy. It can also be predicated as a sign. So a certain behavior or function is a healthy sign, right? This is the sort of thing a healthy person does, as opposed to not. You could have an unhealthy sign too, right? So those are ways in which the natural body and the health of the body can be understood according to a kind of analogical pattern, just using the term healthy. And here, healthy is actually a more primary predication, a more primary identification than other types of accidental qualities. We can make all sorts of less significant, by comparison, observations about the human person. For example, individual virtues and human acts, as important as they are more limited and focused on a particular sphere of the moral life, where someone who has health, who has the quality of bodily health, will do all of those virtuous things across the spectrum as a healthy person. And so being healthy is actually more primary. It's something really said of the essence itself. There's a parallel there between that sense of healthy and the way that we can predicate sanctification or holiness of the same person. Now, natural bodies and natural bodily signs aren't signs of holiness, not in and of themselves, right? Natural medicine isn't a sign of bodily health or of spiritual health, excuse me. And normal, what would be taken to be normal, healthy bodily functions in a medical sense aren't signs of spiritual holiness either, right? So there's an analogy, a kind of comparison between natural health and spiritual health that Aquinas uses to build an understanding of sacraments as signs and as causes, as efficacious instruments by which that reality is coming about. He's building again here on the same cast of characters. You can find a lot of this, at least in broad strokes, in Hugh of St. Victor, certainly, and some of it in Augustine as well. This particular pattern or way of thinking about sacramental signs as repurposing existing matter, existing things, as a means of understanding, as a means of signifying the newness that's happening in recreation and grace. So when we say healthy of the body, it's similar to saying holy, only if it is already the case that the incarnation is a fundamental and transformative reality afoot in the created world. That is, it is something that has happened. It's something that's at work in the church, and it becomes a possibility for us. So things in and of themselves, visible things, can become signs of the incarnation only by the power of God and only by the initiative and wisdom of God. So signs in this sense really apply to all visible realities. Now, earlier I mentioned natural signs, such as the tree signifying the goodness of God, all by itself, without our help. But there are all sorts of other signs, even in a natural sense, that require, if not social mandate or legal mandate, social custom. That is to say, you need more than one person to agree about it for it to be a sign at all. And then on top of that, you'd probably need a number of persons and maybe even a whole culture over time to agree that this is kind of what this means. An example of this is language. So I'm speaking to you in English right now. There are lots of languages in the world. They're not really the product of positive legal prescript from the state so much, not normally. In fact, that actually doesn't work very well if you wanted to change people's speech patterns. It's really within the category of what Aquinas will call custom. So custom, and he's building on Aristotle here, custom is law by analogy. It's law by social consensus over a long period of time. So why do these words I'm saying in English mean what they mean? Well, there's a custom, let's say, a longstanding cultural custom that has ascribed and assigned meaning to certain noises, effectively, right? There are other types of signs. You can think of a stop sign, for example, or other types of street signs that have an element of positive law about them also. That is, probably someone in the government decided it should be that shape. That's why they're all the same in a given country, but the next country over, they look a little different. Right? Often it's still kind of recognizable. It's building on natural signification, potentially. I think there's a certain association with the color red there, probably, that's more than just social custom, but I'm willing to argue that if you want. But both custom and positive law for Aquinas work together to structure the world of conventional signs, what St. Augustine will call conventional signs. And those are signs that develop through social use, effectively. An awful lot of the signs at work in the sacraments and the wider life of the church as an incarnational reality are this type of conventional sign. Now, underlying conventional signs, there's always a natural one. Normally speaking, they're not arbitrary. That's why stop signs make intuitive sense, right? They're not a soothing color. Or a color that encourages you to go faster or something. I don't know. I mean, maybe you get that resonance from them, but I think that underlying the rule and the uniformity imposed by civic law, there's some natural associations, too, that have been kind of repurposed, right, to get the point across. There's something similar happening in the sacramental economy. The difference, of course, is that the signs are not natural. They're certainly not the result of positive civic law. They're the result of divine positive law and custom within the church, in the case of the liturgy, long-standing custom within the church. So let me say a little bit more about that, just in terms of situating the sacramental economy itself as a reality, and then I'll say a bit about the Eucharist more specifically. So when we think about the Eucharist in this sense as a living reality within the church, it's a kind of sacrament, which itself is a kind of conventional sign. That is to say, it's a divinely instituted conventional sign. So God chooses the meaning of the sign. God ascribes the meaning. So when we think about that healthy analogy between healthy and holy, all sacraments function as divinely instituted signs which signify what God is doing to the human person in the incarnation. Now, the Eucharist, especially among all the sacraments, is the most excellent for a number of reasons. St. Thomas lists a number of reasons for considered from a number of different angles for thinking about the Eucharist as the most perfect. But one of them has to do with its nature as a sacrament itself, because it not only signifies and affects, all the sacraments do that, it also contains. And so using that same analogy of holiness in relation to healthiness, so holiness is the health of the spiritual body, effectively, the Eucharist contains a holy reality within it. So it's unique among all the sacraments. Of course, I know you're familiar with the doctrine of the real presence, but when we think about the Eucharist as a sacrament, it's rightly situated as a kind of perfection of the sacramental economy itself, because it is such an evocative sign, so evocative that it contains precisely what it signifies even within the sign itself. The water of baptism doesn't do that. For example, no other sacrament, Aquinas says, has the reality of the sacrament outside of the recipient. So there's no baptism except in the recipient. When a priest baptizes a child and there's water washing, that's the matter, and then says the words, which is the form, I baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The baptism isn't just in the water waiting for the child to show up. The whole reality of the baptism as effect is in the recipient, in the child. By contrast, there's a completion to the Eucharist that's actually in the sacrament itself, in that middle space. We call it the real presence, but it makes it a most excellent form of sacrament. Another thing that the Eucharist contains is the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So when we think about what's in the real presence, if you will, colloquially speaking, it's not only the effect for the recipient sacramentally, but it's also what Christ has done. Because it's Christ himself, of course, Christ substantially contained under the accidents of bread and wine. Sacrifice, in this sense, plays a really important role for Aquinas in delineating the type of human acts that both Christ and we are called to perform, most broadly in the whole theological life, but also directly in the context of the Eucharistic liturgy. So beginning then at the most general sense, sacrifice is a kind of external act of the virtue of religion for St. Thomas. So it's a moral virtue. So you can find it in the Secundus Secundae, if you're interested. In beginning in question 81 and following, sacrifice is in 85, right? So it's a kind of moral virtue. It's also an external act. It's an external act of the virtue of religion. The thing about moral virtue for Aquinas, and he says this right in his treatment of sacrifice, is that it actually needs either custom or positive law to determine the precise nature of what is to be done. The fact that sacrifice itself and religion more broadly is a kind of natural virtue for Aquinas is already quite interesting. It's noticeable, I think, if you look at the history of human cultures, that religion is pretty ubiquitous until fairly recently, right? It's only been a generation or two, but religion... almost any culture has some kind of religion. They're all very different, potentially. But it's also very easy to single out the religious part of a culture you don't know very well. I don't know what they're doing over there, but I'm pretty sure that's the religious part, right? It's because the hardware in human nature, in human anthropology, is laid out. You can find this in Aquinas. You can find corollaries in Aristotle, in Cicero, for example, a significant amount of Aquinas here on this point is drawing from Cicero or Augustine's repurposing of Cicero on natural religion. But that's just to say that religion has a kind of pattern to it that isn't completely dependent on theological categories. What those theological categories are doing as incarnational signs, as a divinizing reality through the power of the incarnation, is repurposing that fundamental hardware of the virtue of religion precisely to serve the living God. Now, briefly, we can think about this in a couple ways. So sacrifice, again, as an external act, begins with the internal acts of religion, which are one, devotion, and two, prayer. So devotion, all this happens in the will, by the way. So these are acts of the will, and they're under the larger virtue of justice. It's a potential part of the virtue of justice. But they're effectively, you can think about devotion as that first motion of the will to love the good. And then prayer is the inner word. You know, when you think about praying yourself, right, there's a sense in which you, you know, talk to God sort of in your head, potentially, right? You know, that's an inner word of understanding. And in the case of the will, it's an inner word of love, right? But the first motion before that sort of speech, if you will, that conscious naming, if you will, of a want or a desire is devotion. All the external acts of religion are signs of the internal ones. Aquinas will say that religion in general, as a moral virtue, is intended for two basic purposes. To recognize God as first principle, so that to recognize that he's God and I'm not, that he's the creator of all reality, that he's responsible for my being, and to give him fitting honor and due praise on that account. And that all of that falls under the category of justice for Aquinas, that because we're creatures, we owe him that much. Now, even in the context of natural religion, you know, I think broadly you can see a lot of different cultures and societies throughout the course of human history struggling with that impulse, because the next question is, what should be done? What should we do? It's one thing to recognize God as first principle and even to recognize that you owe him something. It's something else to decide that you should sacrifice one of the cows, right? I think we should kill one of the cows. Well, it might not be obvious, right? But it's precisely because you need some sort of positive prescript to say that this is how we're going to do it. And it's a social act also, despite what the Enlightenment says about the private nature of religion. In the classical mind, religion is very much a social virtue, something that very much involves the whole of a community and society. Now, thinking again just about natural religion and its relation to both covenantal laws, the law of Moses and then the law of Jesus Christ, natural religion provides a kind of framework that has within it a number of possibilities and also pitfalls, because all of this, the whole realm of possibilities for the human person that are described in the Secunda Pars of the Summa, virtue and vice, oscillate between good and bad, right? There's light and shadow in the post-lapsarian reality of the human person. And religion is no different. So it has vices, right? There are two chief ones, or at least for our purposes here. We can think about idolatry on the one hand and superstition. Idolatry is getting the end of the moral act wrong. So, you know, I get that I need to worship something, but I think it's the tree. So it's mistaking the thing for the sign. Instead of allowing the tree to be a sign of its creator, it becomes an object of worship itself. The other superstition might get the end right, but get the means wrong. That is to say that there's a recognition of God as first principle, let's say, but there's something about the way in which the worship takes place that's manipulative or self-serving in some other sense, right? These are things which can, you know, that aren't excluded, let's say, from the Christian dispensation as well, in various ways. But when we think about the old law, the law of Moses, and the new law in Jesus Christ, the law of grace, these build in many ways on the need for natural rectitude in the area of religion, and then ultimately the need for elevation as image in grace. In the first sense, Aquinas says, and this is in question 102 of the Prima Secunda, if you're interested, Aquinas says that that the old law and its ceremonial precepts, particularly the liturgical and sacrificial stuff, the things that they're doing in the temple in terms of religious rites, that under the auspices of the virtue of religion, they're effectively designed in their literal sense to either promote the correct teleology of religion or end on a secondary note to avoid its vices. So if you think about how specific the law of Moses is, it's pretty specific. If you read Leviticus, what should be done? Well, Leviticus tells you very clearly, right? It also says what should not be done. Don't ever go over there with the Amalekites and do what they're doing. Don't even think about it, right? Definitely don't, do this or that. Only do this and only do it this way at this time. Idolatry is always most obvious when it's someone else's golden calf, of course. So it's interesting, right, how insidious sort of corruptions, let's say, that follow even the pattern of the most obvious religious vices can creep into a whole system, let's say, right? But the letter of the old law, right, for Aquinas is designed specifically to channel the virtue of religion towards its natural end. The old law also, for Aquinas, has a spiritual sense, figurative sense, and that allegorical sense of the old law is a deliberate gesture towards Jesus Christ and the fulfillment of the incarnation. When Aquinas thinks about the faith of the patriarchs, if you think about what Moses believed, for example, or Abraham believed, Aquinas, like a lot of medievals of his day, is quite optimistic, let's say, about how much of the allegorical sense they foresaw. That is to say that they're, in the medieval mind, certainly, there's a certain anticipation of the Messiah that's happening in the act of faith. So that allegorical sense is not insignificant to the life of faith that Moses, for example, or Aaron would have lived themselves as a covenant with God. But in terms of the ceremonial precepts themselves, they're fundamentally designed to order religion rightly in its initial phase and avoid its corruption. In the case of Jesus Christ and the law of grace, it's also the case in the new law that we have precepts, as it were. And the sacraments fall in this realm as specific external precepts for the worship of God. Now, they're signs in one sense of what God is doing, but they're also things to be done. Now, in the broader sense of liturgy, a lot of liturgy falls more under longstanding church custom than outright divine institution. There are a lot of different liturgies, right, even legitimately within the church. And they're quite different, potentially, as different as the Roman Rite and the Syro-Malabar Rite, both very legitimate apostolic rites of apostolic origin, but also very different, right, if you've ever been to one or the other. But the sacraments themselves are the same. The Eucharist is the same in both. But when we think about those realities, even just focusing on the properly sacramental, there's something to be done on our part, right? That is to say, it involves the externality of the human body. It makes a sign out of us, out of our actions, and draws us into the efficacy, the healing, as it were, of the sacramental effects of the incarnation. So the sacraments, and particularly the Eucharist in this sense, are designed by divine wisdom to sustain and amplify the theological life, the renovation and elevation of divine image that happens through the infused gift of faith, hope, and charity, through the gift of grace. So the Eucharist specifically, focusing on the Eucharist as a specific sacrament, particularly in terms of sacrifice. So we said a bit about the Eucharist as a sacrament, but as a sacrifice, the Eucharist, again, it contains the sacrifice of Jesus Christ himself, of course, and applies its effects. In another sense, and this is in 83 of the Tertia Pars, Aquinas will say that the Eucharist is both a sign and an application of the effect of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. So there's all sorts of cruciform imagery spread throughout the Eucharistic liturgy. But if you think about specifically, the example Aquinas gives in 83 is a painting or a picture. I don't know if I have one here to use an example, but the painting that he references, Aquinas, is a painting of Cicero, for example. So if you had one on the wall and pointed to the painting and said, "There is Cicero," you're not wrong. Right? But it's an image of Cicero. So there's a sense in which the whole fabric of the liturgy is a kind of image of the Passion. So when we perceive the Mass, the externalities, the signs of the Mass, certainly most especially the double consecration, where there's a separation of the body and blood of Jesus Christ under the species of bread and the species of wine, there is a signification of the Passion. The second dimension in which the Eucharist is a sacrifice for Aquinas is by the application of the effect of Christ's sacrifice. Now here, there's a specific connection here with the act of charity on our part. So when we think about sacrifice as having an effect on us through the power of the Eucharist, obviously it's Christ's sacrifice that we're participating in, but our own moral life elevated in charity as a supernatural love for God that is teleologically patterned towards beatitude and towards the kingdom of heaven is itself capable of, by participation, offering a kind of sacrifice as a moral act. We know this already from the virtue of religion, that the virtue of religion in its external acts can offer a sacrifice. Now, any sacrifice that we came up with on our own would be of no avail, right? No amount of natural religion in this regard will substitute for a participation in the cross of Jesus Christ. But what the Eucharist allows us to do effectively is to exercise, right, that aspect, that religious aspect of our own persons that's an intrinsic part of who we are and an obligation under the virtue of justice, right, to do so as a participation in the efficacy of the incarnation, particularly in the efficacy of the cross. The virtue of charity, most broadly, and now the charity applies all the days of our life, all day long, right, as the formality that unites us in the theological life in the love of God. But specifically in the liturgy, charity has this special role to play. And it's really here that we see the connection with sacrifice for Aquinas as a personal act, as a personal offering. The Eucharist, if we're disposed, that is, if we're in a state of grace, to use the catechetical distinction, if we're not undisposed to receive communion for some reason, the Eucharist will always strengthen the habitus of charity, the habit of charity within us. If we're disposed at all, even in the most nominal sense, it will have that effect, no matter how distracted we are at Mass, for example, right? No matter how, you know, let's say mediocre our act of contrition was at the penitential rite, you know, that sort of thing. Provided we're reasonably well disposed and we're in a state of grace, the Eucharist will always strengthen the habit of charity. But a more perfect and more fitting sacrifice is for it to strengthen and call forth and elicit the act of charity itself in the context of the liturgy itself. Charity in act has about itself the fruit of joy. And Aquinas mentions this specifically in 79 of the Tertia Pars, that the Eucharist at its perfection, although in one sense it's perfect as a sacrament, even if no one receives it, it's still the Eucharist in the tabernacle. But its full effect, its full reality is in the body of Christ alive in charity. And so for each one of us to be drawn more deeply in, not only by habit, but by act, and an act which finds not only its perfection teleologically in its object and end, but enjoys it with an overflowing joy as a fruit of charity, is the ultimate fruition of the effect of the Eucharist. So on a practical level, and I'll conclude here, as I know I'm at the end of my time, but on a practical level, the thinking about the Eucharist as a sacrifice in which we participate is an incredible encouragement, I think, to a kind of active participation, which is focused first and foremost on the interior acts of the virtue of religion that overflow into the externalities of the liturgy. In a second sense, it also provides us with a theological or intellectual way of understanding liturgy and sacrifice as a Christological and incarnational reality that speaks to the very heart of the church and the identity of us all together as the body of Jesus Christ. Peter Lombard described the Eucharist in this sense as having a twofold flesh. The first is the flesh born of Mary, which is contained, the flesh of Jesus Christ himself in bodily form, contained under the accidents. The second flesh is the church, however. And so that our flesh united, again, not only in habit, but in the act of charity, provides a kind of secondary incarnational sign that witnesses to the world the onset of the kingdom of God. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast.
Thanks a lot.